From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
President Trump says that churches should be considered essential. Tweaks may be coming to the Paycheck Protection Program, and Joe Biden makes his first public appearance in months. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. Sitting in today for Paul Jugot, we are joined today by my colleagues, Bill McGurn. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Kyle.
And Alicia Finley. Hi, Alicia.
Hi, Kyle.
Churches have been fighting lockdown orders in lots of places, and on Friday, President Trump waded in at a news conference. Here's a quote from the official White House transcript, quote, "Today I'm identifying houses of worship, churches, synagogues, and mosques as essential places that provide essential services. Some governors have deemed liquor stores and abortion clinics as essential, but have left out churches and other houses of worship. It's not right," unquote. Bill, how did you read those remarks?
Well, I think the president was absolutely right insofar as what you just quoted. And in fact, about a month before, his attorney general, Bill Barr, issued a paper saying there's no pandemic exception to the Constitution. So the First Amendment still applies. The real issue in the churches is that some of the lockdown orders treated the churches differently from similar institutions. In other words, you can put restrictions on everyone, including churches, but you can't single out churches for different treatment. You have to treat religious and secular activities the same. So you had some of these anomalies, such as Minnesota, where, you know, they allow the Mall of America to reopen, but they say churches had to keep their congregations limited to 10 people or fewer, even if they were outdoors. And this is all, I think, being resolved now.
What got some criticism was the second part of President Trump's remarks. So he went on to say, here's another quote, "The governors need to do the right thing and allow these very important essential places of faith to open right now for this weekend. If they don't do it, I will override the governors," unquote. And so the reaction, Alicia, from critics was that he's overstating his power, not for the first time, and this is just pandering to religious voters. I mean, what do you make of that? Or is this a good and proper use of the president's bully pulpit?
Well, I think that he doesn't have the power to override governors right here, but the Justice Department can file amicus briefs in these cases. And we have found that there have been cases in Kentucky where the state lost this case. And I think, I mean, you saw over the weekend or on Monday, Gavin Newsom at least, you know, did listen and came out with guidance allowing churches and places of worship to reopen with some recommendations, you know, 25% occupancy, you know, suggesting wearing face masks. But I think you are actually seeing governors both heed not necessarily Trump's bully pulpit, but at least, you know, citizens who want churches to reopen.
Yeah, some of these cases we've talked about on earlier podcasts, the Department of Justice's intervention in the Virginia court case, and then the Sixth Circuit's ruling for a Kentucky church. And Bill, now, in addition, there's another state, Minnesota, where the Catholic Archdiocese and the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod had said they were going to hold services in defiance of the orders from Governor Tim Walz. And now the parties have come to some sort of compromise there.
Absolutely, Kyle. And I think the Minnesota case gets back to the fundamental issue, which is discriminatory treatment, which is prohibited by the First Amendment's guarantees of free exercises. Last week, to go back to it, Governor Walz on Wednesday announced a new phase of reopening. And under this phase, for just one example, bars would be allowed to serve outdoors people of, you know, up to 50 people, and similar kind of openings for retail, as I said, including the Mall of America. Churches, meanwhile, had nothing. They were still limited to 10 people. It's just insane. A bar can have 50 people outdoors, and a church can't. So the Archbishop of Minneapolis, St. Paul, along with a Lutheran colleague, basically wrote a letter to the governor saying what he was doing was unconstitutional, And they were sorry, but they were going ahead and reopening this week without them. So up to then, the governor had ignored these religious leaders. He got into meetings with them Thursday and Friday, and they announced what they should have done at the beginning, a compromise. And so the churches will be allowed to open at 25% capacity, and there'll be some protocols on hygiene and distancing and so forth. And I think that's the way we want it. There are practical resolutions to this. It need not come down to a constitutional case each time. And I think Governor Walz looked at the record you outlined in the court cases and realized he was going to lose and it was going to be embarrassed. In addition to the unappetizing political prospect of, are you going to arrest or cite people merely for going to church? So that one worked out. And I think the other ones will too, along the same lines.
Yeah. And I wonder if that record is part of what kind of motivated California Governor Gavin Newsom to move as well. So there, a church, the South Bay United Pentecostal Church, had been fighting in court. And last week, the Ninth Circuit rejected its request for a preliminary injunction. The opinion there quoted Justice Robert Jackson saying that if a court, quote, does not temper its doctrinaire logic with a little practical wisdom, it will convert the constitutional Bill of Rights into a suicide pact, unquote. There was a dissent from one judge who said essentially that churches in the state's reopening plan are explicitly and categorically treated differently. And so that's on its face, undeniably religious discrimination against religious conduct. So the church lost in the Ninth Circuit and then appealed to the Supreme Court. And Alicia, I mean, I wonder if that that case record going back in the other states and the potential of the Supreme Court weighing in is part of what motivated Governor Newsom's U-turn.
I mean, maybe I would see. I'm not sure the. I mean, there would be a split in the circuits, so perhaps the Supreme Court would have been interested in taking it. But I think Newsom was also just motivated by public pressure and did see, you know, what Minnesota did, and that there is a way to find a pragmatic compromise. I only wish that some governors would realize that that's not just true in this case of coronavirus, but in other cases where they have refused to accommodate religious people, such as, I mean, I think you've written about with the contraception mandates and such.
Yeah, and California's lockdown in particular was early and has been long. And Alicia, you've looked at some of the economic results there. What does it show?
Well, I mean, California has been locked down for 10 weeks, which is about the same as New York, New Jersey, Illinois, Connecticut. Newsom, to his credit, is starting to allow counties to reopen faster than other counties that do not want to. So, for instance, Orange County now is allowing dining inside as well as in-store retail. But the problem is it's been locked down so long, you've had an incredible number of people who have lost their jobs. 4.2 million have filed for unemployment claims in California. Many of these people, almost half of them retail, or not retail, but rather leisure and hospitality. So people who work in, you know, in hotels, whether they work in restaurants, taco stands, it's a good number of people, even in retail, construction, have also lost their jobs, or higher than in other states that didn't keep their lockdowns or weren't as strict. And I think this is going to be even a bigger issue in places like Los Angeles and San Francisco, the Bay Area, which are still keeping relatively strict lockdowns. Not allowing in-store retail, not allowing restaurants, because the longer these places aren't allowed to open up, they still have other obligations, you know, rents, mortgage, utilities that they have to pay, even if they lay off workers. You're going to have, you know, evictions, foreclosures, bankruptcies, and what happens to those workers who used to, they're not going to have jobs to come back to. And you know, it's a bit of a domino effect. And if those workers don't have jobs to come back to, they're not, even once, you know, the federal stimulus expires and enhanced unemployment benefits expire, they're not going to be able to patronize these or go out and shop and dine out and such. So they're looking at a prolonged recession. There's some forecasts estimating that McKinsey put out that 40% of, you know, Los Angeles and around 37% San Francisco will have lost income or jobs during this time. And what is going to be that effect? What is that effect going to be on the long term of the health of these states' economies and state budgets? That's going to be a real huge issue for several years.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. On the subject of California's lockdown in particular, the line from the Journal's editorial that jumped out at me was that 4% of construction workers in Florida have lost their jobs, compared with 17% in California and even higher numbers like 27% in New Jersey. And Bill, one of the questions that we've been talking about a little bit, a lot of people have been talking about, is how fast after, as the lockdowns start to ease, how fast the economy will come back. And there's a quote that is making the rounds from Jason Furman, one of Obama, President Obama's top economic advisors, who seems to think that it's going to be pretty fast. So the quote is that, quote, "We're about to see the best economic data we've seen in the history of this country," unquote. And even if unemployment is higher than it was before, he's talking about the growth in it and suggesting that it may be a potential problem for Joe Biden and Democrats in November.
Yeah, I mean, the inference from that is that some of the Democrats are rooting for the lockdowns to continue so that President Trump doesn't benefit from this growth. But I think it makes sense. If you look at the economic crisis, it's not because of anything in the economy. It's because of a pandemic that's forced people to close down. The demand is still there. We don't really need a stimulus. The demand is there. It's just that we haven't been able to have the supply to opening. The difference in the states, I think it points to one of the things that we tend to overlook. There are lockdowns and there are lockdowns, and there's a lot of variation in between. There really hasn't been the choice, as sort of implied, between a place that's fully locked down and a place that's fully opened up. Even the ones that open up like Florida, you know, it's very different based on the conditions on the ground. So I think that's what the data are telling us about place. I think that Florida allowed more. And to me, it has a sensible approach, which is the approach, let's identify the most vulnerable parts and try to protect the people in those populations. And then let's see what we can open. You know, the attitude is, let's see what we can open without affecting public health. And I think that's a sensible approach.
Yeah, and it's true, though, that the longer the lockdowns go on and the longer the businesses go without customers and revenues, the more of them will fail and the deeper the real economic damage becomes. One of Washington's efforts on that front has been the Paycheck Protection Program. And there's been some talk of changing it to make it more open, fixing it in some ways. Alicia, do you think Congress Washington is getting any closer on some true fixes to the program?
Well, I think there's a bipartisan consensus to do away with this stipulation, that an arbitrary stipulation that Steve Mnuchin put on the program, that to receive loan forgiveness, you have to spend 95% of the loan on payroll, which is very impractical for small businesses who have high overhead costs. And this is high overhead costs, especially in coastal cities, New York City, San Francisco, where they have high rents. Even if they have high labor costs, their overhead is much higher than their payroll. And especially if they can't hire workers, or they because of unemployment, the enhanced unemployment benefits, they may actually have a hard time hiring workers back. That makes it even harder to receive loan forgiveness, which is also why there is some consensus to extend also the duration in which you have to use the loan from right now under the CARES Act, it's 8 weeks, whether to do it to 16 or 24 weeks to allow workers or companies more time to hire back workers that they had to lay off.
Yeah, and we'll see if there's some compromise on the number of weeks that they want to extend it. But Bill, Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, has defended some of the restrictions put on it. So here's a quote from him last week. He said, it's called the Paycheck Protection Program. It's not called the Overhead Protection Program. We believe that the 75% was exactly consistent with the way the program was designed, unquote. I mean, what about that argument?
Well, I think this is the general problem with the government relief efforts. You know, if you put too many restrictions on, the money doesn't really help people, right? And this is true whether it's a loan, as in this case, or helping people rebuild. I remember after Katrina, all the problems getting some payments to people in time so they could build. And it's this tension. If you put too many restrictions on, you may save the taxpayers' dollars from being wasted or stolen, but you may also make it that the money doesn't make a difference because it doesn't reach people in time or give them the flexibility they need. To me, what this points out is I think that they can expand the parameters a little bit, as Alicia mentioned, allow a few more weeks, maybe expand the payroll, that 75% restriction, maybe ease that a little depending on what they've learned. But again, to me, what this points to is the government is not the answer to getting us out of this, to keeping businesses alive. Opening up is. There is no substitute for just opening up the economy, because the economy, these are the people who create wealth. Just throwing federal dollars doesn't create any wealth. And I think it's just an imperative to get us up and running as quickly as we can.
Finally, Joe Biden has ventured out in public on Memorial Day. He went to a ceremony in Delaware wearing a black face mask. He also made news on Friday for a comment on a radio show telling an African-American interviewer, quote, if you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, then you ain't black, unquote. Biden later apologized for that, saying that he shouldn't have been so cavalier and that he doesn't take the black community for granted. But Alicia, I mean, maybe he's better off being sequestered in his basement and not out on a line where he has to answer questions from voters all day long.
Well, I think that's right. The longer the lockdowns go on, or everyone stays sheltered at home, the better for him. He's now under pressure, and he has shown again and again that he has these lapses. You could call them gaps, but he's not a great on the stump. If he has to start going out again, meeting people, he may tire, fatigue, and that is an advantage probably to Trump.
On the other hand, Bill, there's something to be said for going out in a mask, and you can't really say anything. You can't get close to anybody. You can't talk to anybody. You just go to a ceremony in your mask and you salute and you're seen in public and you get some photographs taken of you. I mean, maybe that's going to be his mode of campaigning here for a couple months.
It might. Look, we all laugh at Joe Biden and his many gaffes and his problems, recording something from his basement and all the attendant missteps that go with that. But it's actually served him pretty well if you look at the polls. And I think that's partly because there's so much of a storm around President Trump. And I think that Joe Biden is sort of campaigning on a return to normalcy. I'm not sure it hurts him to not be seen, to be quite as visible. And the other issue you raised, his statement about if you're voting for Trump, you ain't black. Okay, it was very flip and it was a stupid statement. But what I take from that is Joe Biden invited this. This is the cost of identity politics. He had the support of the black community. It helped get him the nomination, but it's never enough. He's already promised to pick a woman for his vice presidential ticket. And I think he's promised to put an African-American on the Supreme Court. It's just never enough. He's going to be constantly, they're going to be demanding more. And so I think he invited this when he went down that road.
You say that it's worked out pretty well for him so far, but one place where he is still struggling is in the money game. I mean, he's way behind the president in fundraising, and obviously fundraising isn't everything because Hillary Clinton spent more than Trump did, I believe, and it didn't really help all that much. But there's an interesting story in the Journal's news pages the other day where they looked at Bernie Sanders donors and compared them to Joe Biden donors. I mean, Bernie Sanders was a monster at small dollar online fundraising and had about 2.2 million donors. And of those, only about 3%, about 60,000 of them, have given to Joe Biden's campaign. And there were a couple quotes from them. There was someone saying, you know, I'll vote for Joe Biden, but I'm not going to give him my money until he goes for Medicare for All. And it speaks to, Alicia, I think, the problem that he's still having in locking down the left wing, the progressive side of his party. I mean, that has been what he's been trying to do all along, where he's moved adopting plans from Sanders, adopting plans from Elizabeth Warren. But if you look at the money, it looks like it's not worked all that well.
Well, I think that's right. And meantime, the question is if he's doing more harm and not just, I mean, in terms of will his leftward shift hurt him among the quote unquote moderates or for that matter, Trump voters, working class people who he needs to win in November. It seems to me that he's not winning one way or the other and that he's probably is doing himself more damage.
All right. Thank you, Bill and Alicia. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.